This is case number 73889, Dominic Magliardetti et al., appellants versus Transit First Group, Inc. et al. Respondents, we also have amicus curiae. Parties, Mr. Cook representing appellants, Mr. Bexley representing the respondents, Ms. Goldsmith representing the amicus. How we'll do this time-wise is this. Each side, of course, the appellants has 15 minutes each. You can reserve part of your time on the 15 if you want to go last after everybody's spoken. So we'll go with you first. We'll hear from Ms. Goldsmith for her 10 minutes. So the respondents have heard from both sides before you get up, since you don't have rebuttal, and we want to give you an opportunity to do that. And Mr. Cook, as the appellant, you'll have the last say on it. So you decide how much time you want to reserve. Okay, you ready to proceed? Thank you.
And just one clarification. I do represent the appellants, but for Dominic Magliardetti. He's not represented here today.
Okay, thank you for that. And also, Justice Silver is not here. She will participate in the decision of the case and listen to the arguments we have here today before she does so. Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Mark Cook. I represent the appellant but for Dominic Magliardetti in this case, and I wanted to first go through some of the facts that I think are pertinent to the substance of the argument. On February 7th, 2000, Francine Magliardetti and Dominic Magliardetti entered into a transmutation agreement whereby their community property became her sole and separate property. Now, that agreement was restated again in 2006. All of the defendant trusts and entities that are appellants in this case, defendants in the federal action, are the corpus of that transmutation agreement. It all started with that separate property agreement. She created the trusts. The entities are the corpus of the trusts. In December of 2006 is when TransFirst first commenced their action against Dominic Magliardetti and other defendants. They received a judgment in April 2013, and at the very latest, based on the complaint and the deposition they attached, which are Appendix 884 and 135, at the very latest, June 24th, 2014, is when they became aware of the transmutation agreement and the trusts. The current lawsuit was filed 2 years and 4 days later, June 30th, 2016. The complaint does not challenge the creation or formation of the transmutation agreement. The word transmutation doesn't appear in the complaint. And in fact, during the preliminary hearing in this, with that regard, counsel stated on the Appendix 903, the challenge here is not to the transmutation agreement, it is to the subsequent transfer of assets. And it continued later on, but still the same page. Each one of those transfers, we believe, not the transmutation agreement, but each one of those transfers that's happening now, continuing to happen at least prior to the TRO, is a fraudulent transfer. So again, they do not challenge the transmutation agreement. And by the way, they do not challenge the formation of the trusts. The allegations they have in the complaint are for what they allege to be an alter ego cause of action, which alleges a unity of interest between Dominic and the entities and trusts. And the second cause of action is a fraudulent transfer cause of action, as it's titled in the complaint. And paragraph 59 of that complaint describes a non-exhaustive summary list of fraudulent transactions, the earliest of which is July 1st, 2014. Again, significant because the transmutation agreement was formed in 2000 and is not challenged in this. Nonetheless, the federal court ultimately granted a temporary restraining order, which restrains the Spendthrift Trust's ability to use any assets. It froze it for all purposes, for general living expenses, children's college tuition, attorney's fees, everything. While acknowledging, by the way, that the trusts, and I'm quoting from the order for reconsideration, meet the requirements of Spendthrift Trusts, and plaintiffs, respondents here, do not dispute that they do. He did, though, in reviewing the Klobaka decision in reconsideration, note that Klobaka passed out on my ruling, so ultimately he certified the seven questions we're here today on. Two of those questions, does alter ego apply to partnerships, and does alter ego apply to limited liability companies? The one thing we seem to agree on is the second Gardner decision resolved that. So both of us just briefed the other five issues. So with that background, I'd like to start with that alter ego is a remedy, not a cause of action, unless anybody wants to direct me elsewhere.
You may proceed however you wish, Klein.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, we know alter ego is a remedy, not a cause of action, because this court in LFC Marketing identified that the equitable remedy of piercing the corporate veil is, and then the analysis of that equitable remedy, in that case, a reverse piercing. So we have Nevada Supreme Court law clearly, specifically stating it's a remedy. I don't think that wording was accidental. 4 years prior to that ruling, the United States Supreme Court in Peacock versus Thomas spent several different notations in that case noting that veil-piercing claim does not state a cause of action, and piercing the corporate veil is not in and of itself an independent, in that case, ERISA cause of action, but is a means of imposing liability on an underlying cause of action. That case has been interpreted in the Ninth Circuit and elsewhere, and particularly in the Ninth Circuit in Local 159342, 343, and 44. It's a 185 F3rd 978 case we cite in the brief. Cites to the Peacock case stating, a request to pierce the corporate veil is only a means of imposing liability for an underlying cause of action and is not a cause of action in and of itself. And it continues, you could not pierce the corporate veil unless and until the plaintiff could establish a right to their money through a separate cause of action. And again, the thing is that just makes plain sense. If at my law firm I am not following corporate formalities, using the assets as my own personal piggy bank, all those earmarks commingling, that doesn't make me culpable to any third-party creditor. There has to be an independent underlying cause of action to get to me.
Sure, Mr. Cook, but we have parties here who already obtained a judgment on the merits against Mr. Megler-Deedy based on claims that they have apparently proven and gotten a judgment on. And so now the question is, does that judgment apply to your clients?
Right. That's exactly right. But the difference is, and what is discussed in the Peacock case and its progeny, is there's no factual interdependence with that prior judgment. There's no culpability. That is a judgment, as you said, against Dominic Magliardi.
Right.
I don't represent Dominic Magliardi.
Sure, but then what they have to show in this case, at least on that part of their case, putting aside fraudulent transfer, is a likelihood of success on establishing your clients are, in fact, alter egos.
Right, but what they need to have to do that is an underlying cause of action of culpability against these entities, and that's the part that's missing.
But doesn't Cali and Mona, those two cases, stand for the proposition that you have to do it in an independent cause of action?
I agree that, yes, they do, and you do have to do an independent cause of action, but you need a substantive cause of action against my clients to do that. Mona actually doesn't do any analysis of alter ego. It was part of the original judgment with the substantive matter, but it wasn't discussed in the Mona case because it wasn't brought before the court as an issue. As to the Cali case, and really the Mona case too, they're notice due process issues. You can't bring somebody in without giving them notice. A couple distinctions, though, between them and why we're here. First, Cali certainly doesn't overrule LFC. It doesn't even mention LFC. It doesn't analyze why we would change what LFC talks about with regard to a remedy. And what we also have in Cali, which I think is a very significant factual difference, is they had a judgment in Cali against the entity and then went after the individual who owned that entity. Now, what the Cali case says is you need an independent cause of action. It doesn't identify that independent cause of action can only be alter ego because that, as a due process and notice case, wasn't part of that analysis. Here, what they're trying to do is go from a judgment against Dominic Magliardi and tie it into a trust. And remember, all the entities of the corporate are the trust. That he is not a trustee, a trustor, nor a beneficiary. And you can't make that jump. You need some independent set of facts to tie my client into that. They don't allege them. To the extent that they try and allege them, they try and allege them through the Fraudulent Transfer Act, but because that doesn't stand up, that's why this aspect of the question is certified. And the other thing I would add is in 2017, we had Senate Bill 57, which came along into law, which is providing more protection for corporations, not less. So there's no ruling, there's no reason to overrule that aspect of LFC, and in fact, the protections, particularly in Nevada, are moving away from that kind of expansion, because as the court stated in Klobaka, which dealt with trusts, we're looking to provide, the legislator is looking to provide that kind of corporate protection to entice businesses to come here. So this really isn't the time to expand it. There's no reason to expand it. And even the underlying aspects of why you would try to expand it aren't present, because what we have here is the transmutation agreement that created this foundation.
Respectfully, though, Mr. Cook, I mean, this is largely an academic exercise. We are not deciding the facts of this case in determining what is actually correct. We're trying to answer these legal questions on existing jurisprudence and whether we're making jurisprudence. So
I agree with that. But under Volvo, I mean, the reason we get to do this, or you get to do this, is because it has some dispositive nature in the case. And so that's why, from my perspective, I think it's important to not just look at LFC, but the context of having that intertwining set of facts that don't exist because they're not alleged against my client, which wasn't an issue in Cali and wasn't discussed at all in Mona. And to the extent that it's been addressed by the Supreme Court, it's been done so consistent with the Peacock decision, the United States Supreme Court decision, which says it is not a cause of action. It is a remedy. You need the accompanying cause of action. And again, the accompanying cause of action in all the cases that have followed through that way was under that same intertwined set of facts, which we don't have here, which, if I may, I'd like to segue into why alter ego doesn't apply to trusts either. Unless we had an outstanding question on that. I hope I answered it.
I want you to go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to trusts, I'm going to my preference would be to just go with the analysis that the amicus curiae brief made. It doesn't quite go as far as we made in ours, but we went under it, and it's pretty clear, and I thought they presented it pretty clear. And I'd like to start with the revocable and irrevocable aspects, non-spendthrift, even though in our case the federal court judge has already said it is a spendthrift, but I think it aids in the transition. What the amicus curiae brief says with regard to revocable trusts is you can't keep pierce the corporate veil because you could already get to the settlor for a debt of the settlor anyway. Well, in this case, the settlor is Francine Magliardi. There is Dominic Magliardi was not the settlor. So,
but what was the source of the corpus of the trust that Mrs. Magliardi used to create it?
Her separate income as a result of that transmutation agreement. That's what started that estate planning process. So that it becomes her separate property. She then sets it up in the trust. They know about the transmutation agreement at least 2 years and 4 days before the challenge.
Okay, I got that. Okay.
So if under the amicus brief where you could get to the, you don't need to pierce a corporate veil because you can get to the settlor already. Well, the settlor here is Francine, and the debtor here is Dominic. So even it's crazy to me from an analytical standpoint to think you could get to, we would have more protection under a revocable trust than we would under a spendthrift, which, as I'll go through, is why the analysis they have in spendthrift doesn't make sense. Because under revocable, with the amicus' argument, they could only get to the settlor if they had a judgment against the settlor. And again, they don't. They have a judgment against Dominic. They don't have a judgment against the settlor. The same analysis applies.
So Dominic isn't the settlor. Is he the trustee?
No.
Is he the beneficiary?
No. He's a potential contingent beneficiary under one of the trusts. But that's just not enough. Under that analysis, if it's distributed to him and in his pocket, they could attach it. But what happened here is the federal judge instructed the trustee of the trust and the trust itself that it cannot disperse funds for any purpose based on a judgment against somebody who is not the trustee, not the trustor, and not subject to any direct link in there because, again, the original documents weren't signed.
Do you want to reserve the balance of your time, Mr. Cook?
Yes, I think I have to, even though I have two questions.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, you have about less than 2 minutes. Okay, Ms. Goldsmith, on behalf of the State Bar Probate and Trust Section.
May it please the court, justices. My name is Dara Goldsmith. I am the amicus section head of the probate and trust section at the State Bar. Along with me, I have a couple of members. Michelle Rafferty, she is the chair of the probate and trust section. And Bart Mallory is with us as well. The brief that you received was the work of about 15 members of our section, which had been approved by the section. And went through a number of iterations. But we felt it very important to be involved in this brief, first and foremost, in the ability to answer the questions. The first question that was posed to us was, does alter ego apply to trusts? And as my colleague stated, with regard to traditional revocable trusts, it really doesn't need to, because those trusts are amendable. Those assets are merely for probate avoidance or for ease of, in the event of guardianship. They really serve just an estate planning purpose and not asset protection. The second question that was posed by the district court in the certification was, do the alter ego provisions apply to spendthrift trusts? And the section urges the court to adopt the position that the alter ego doctrine does not apply to a spendthrift trust where the settlor or the trustor, whichever terminology you prefer, and the trustee have acted in accordance with the trust instrument and the Nevada statutes. It's pretty clear when you look at the statutes that we do contemplate, and the legislature contemplates, all three of us have been involved in many of the members on this briefing are involved in the probate legislative section. And it's clear that it's contemplated in 163.418 that alter ego could apply to trusts, because in 163.418 it states, absent clear and convincing evidence, if a party asserts a settlor is the alter ego of a trustee of the trust, the following factors alone or in combination are not sufficient evidence for the court to find that the settlor controls or is the alter ego of the trustee. So by its own definition in this provision, it's clear that it's possible there could be some facts that could be presented to a court wherein the trust and the settlor would be the alter ego, the trustee would be the alter ego of one another. In 2009, the legislature, and these laws have been on the books and have been being used.
Even in the case of a spendthrift trust?
Even in the case of a spendthrift trust, it could apply. It's possible. It's possible when you get into it, but if you follow the rules.
I thought those provisions were focusing only on a irrevocable trust.
The 163 is for an irrevocable trust. So first we'll deal with that. And then also on the spendthrift, if you've complied with all of the rules and you've met the requirements, then there wouldn't be a possibility. If you had not conformed in a spendthrift scenario, so for instance, if the 2 years hadn't expired or 6 months of finding the assets, then you could have a situation where those assets would not be, the spendthrift would not be respected.
But that wouldn't be because of an alter ego remedy. That would be because of the failure to comply with the statutory.
It could be. It would be the failure to comply. But then you still would have. You'd have that failure to comply that would enable you to look to other provisions. I think that would be a possibility. It's much more difficult when you're looking at the spendthrift provisions. If you're in Chapter 166. That if you've complied with 166 and you've complied with 163, then you wouldn't have a situation where you could find alter ego. You would have to have non-compliance.
So my question really is, in that context, don't those statutory provisions supersede what is previously considered, I think, a common law claim of alter ego.
So in the situation where you've met the requirements with a spendthrift, as you set forth, then alter ego would not apply in a spendthrift because you would have met all the requirements. And if you've done everything that has been required to settle that trust correctly and you've operated it correctly, then it would not be subject to alter ego. That's very important from the legislative perspective because when people choose Nevada as a place to domicile their trust, it's important to make sure that you understand the laws that are going
to
be applied.
I ask again, isn't that the distinction between a spendthrift trust, at least as I got the amicus brief and my understanding of the statutes, and an alter ego claim against the trustee of an irrevocable trust?
That would be correct. There is the difference because if you could find the alter ego in the one, you could find the alter ego in the one, in the 163, just based upon the relationship, based upon those factors, and the factors that are set forth.
The reason I pose these questions, Ms. Goldsmith, is because I didn't have a chance to look at all the trusts here, but my understanding is that, for example, the DJM Irrevocable Trust is not a spendthrift trust, but is an irrevocable trust. I was going to ask this question before counsel sat down, but the Fain Trust, perhaps, I'm not certain, is a spendthrift trust. I'm not sure about the breakdown of those, and that needs some clarification. So, I know that was beyond the scope of the
amicus. It would be beyond the scope of what we looked at. We didn't get involved necessarily.
I'm trying to extend the reasoning from the amicus brief on the legal issues to the trusts that are in front of this court in this case.
If a trust were before this court that was an irrevocable trust that was within 163, then you would look to the factors which there would have to be clear and convincing evidence of the alter ego, and there's factors that are insufficient. So you have the factors that are listed in 163.418, and the legislature contemplates that those factors are insufficient. So you would need something more egregious than those factors. And if you were presented with those factors with clear and convincing evidence, then you could find that alter ego would apply. There is much more flexibility to apply the alter ego provisions or as a remedy where you have a straight irrevocable trust and you are looking at the factors in the egregious behavior. When you're looking at the self-settled spendthrift trust under 166, if it's complied with in its establishment, meaning that it's met the requirements, it's dealt with the period of limitations and all of those factors, then that trust should be respected and would not have the opportunity, absent running afoul of another, within the time frame rules. If every rule was followed with regard to the self-settled spendthrift trust, then it would not be subject to alter ego. I hope that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. It is. Thank you. And
so realistically, one of the things that's very important for the section is that because these statutes have been on the books, one of the things we see that Judge Gordon had pointed out, that California had very different laws. That is true. There's 17 other states. 17 states have adopted asset protection laws like Nevada has. And although sometimes our laws are very similar to our neighbor to the west, our laws are very different in the area of asset protection. Many entities, whether they're trust companies, individuals, family businesses, come to Nevada. And it's important to have that our laws are being respected and interpreted pursuant to the words set forth therein. We feel that the statutes are very clear in 163 and 166 with regard to what's required for a settlor to find asset protection in our state. And what it may not be as clear as under 163 when they violate that, but it has to be something more egregious than what's set forth in the statutes. And it's important that that as attorneys and as trustors or business people that we can rely upon the words, the black letter law, the statutes of our state. And based upon that, the trust section of the state bar requests that this court proceed with the recommendations in the amicus brief and you know, apply those factors and provide direction to the federal court so the federal court can make its appropriate decisions going forward. Any questions?
Questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Goldsmith. Thank you, and thank your section for taking up our request here to file a brief.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to brief this important issue and for the opportunity to appear here. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Bexley.
May it please the court, my name is Tyler Bexley, and I represent the respondents and the plaintiffs in the federal lawsuit below. Nevada law has long recognized the alter ego doctrine as a permissible, equitable method of imposing liability for a judgment on a third party when justice so requires. That is the precise reason we are here today, and the precise reason that the plaintiffs filed the action in the federal court below. The plaintiffs have a valid and binding judgment against Dominic Magliarditi that was affirmed by the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. I'm not going to get deeply into the facts because I don't think it's necessary for purposes of answering the certified question, but I would note two important disputes that I have with the way the facts were presented by the appellants. First, I would note that it is incorrect that TransFirst and the plaintiffs are not challenging the validity of the underlying transmutation agreements. That was not an issue presented to the court at the preliminary injunction stage because of the expedited nature of the proceeding, but since that time, evidence has developed that will lead to that being pursued ultimately. Unfortunately, we have been prevented from doing so because, as the court knows, there is a bankruptcy stay that has prevented any further litigation in the underlying matter. Second, I would reject the characterization of any of our claims as time-barred or subject to any sort of statute of limitations. Those are factual disputes that ought to be litigated in the federal district court and have not been litigated on a full factual record. And I believe they will be once the bankruptcy stay is lifted down the road.
Well, even if you disagree, about the transmutation agreement, you do agree, at least consistent with Judge Gordon's order on page 14, line 26, that the transfers to the so-called insiders or these entities were by Francine.
I agree that on the factual record that he had before him at the time, it certainly appeared that way. I don't believe that the evidence...
That's what he says here. And when we address a certified question, we're to accept the facts as laid out, not by either one of you folks, but the certified order that the court has given us.
Understood, Your Honor, and for purposes of this certified question, I would defer to that factual finding with the caveat that we may be in a position where we're litigating that to a jury with different facts because of what we've discovered in the interim. Turning to the first certified question.
Could you clarify something for me? I'm sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
I know you're anxious to get into some of these other areas, and but I would like to know of the appellants here, I know you're pursuing claims against Ms. Magliardi in her individual capacity, as I understand it.
That's correct.
So the certified questions really don't have anything to do with her.
I believe that's correct, except in her capacity as the trustee.
Yeah, so let's focus on that. Is the DJM irrevocable trust an irrevocable trust, or is it a spendthrift trust?
I don't want to commit to an answer because it's been so long since I've looked at that part of the record.
Oh.
But my understanding, and I'll let counsel correct me if I'm wrong, is that it is an irrevocable trust and not a spendthrift.
Okay, how about the Fain Trust?
I believe that one is a spendthrift trust.
Okay, and those are the only two trusts I see in the caption or saw on the briefs. Is that right?
That is correct.
And all these corporate entities are assets of one or the other of these two trusts. Is that right?
According to the defendant, yes.
And according to Judge Gordon's order?
Again, according to the facts as they were presented at that time, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. So of in either the DJM Trust or the Fain Trust, is Dominic Magliardi a beneficiary of either one of those trusts?
I believe he is a contingent beneficiary of one or both of those trusts. if I'm remembering correctly, it is the Fain Trust, that he is a contingent beneficiary.
The Spendthrift Trust.
Correct.
Okay. And then is he a shareholder or a member of either the corporate entities or LLC entities that are before this court?
He is not a formal member, but Judge Gordon made a finding that by his acts, that he was participating as if he were a member of the company, and thus those entities are his alter egos.
But he's not a shareholder or a in the operating agreement of an LLC, a member?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the clarification.
Turning quickly to the first certified question, which it deals with whether alter ego is a claim or a remedy, I think the semantic distinction that counsel made of whether you call it a claim or a remedy is really not relevant. What is relevant is whether my client or any judgment creditor can bring a separate claim against a new third party to impose liability for the underlying judgment. And the answer, according to the Cali and the Mona cases, is undisputedly has to be yes. That is the very purpose of asserting an alter ego claim. If it were true that there had to be a substantive underlying cause of action, my client or any judgment creditor would have asserted a substantive underlying cause of action in the earlier proceeding that resulted in the judgment against Mr. Magliardidi.
Well, unless they made a mistake and left them out.
Well,
There's that possibility, isn't there?
I suppose that could hypothetically be true, although that's not the case here. The case here
isn't his point that if you're going to bring an alter ego claim, there has to be another claim of culpability attached.
And I believe that.
And so with respect to the underlying facts that gave rise to the dominant judgment, were there claims against Francine?
No. It is undisputed that she was not a tort defendant.
Okay.
Our position is that the very purpose of the alter ego doctrine, however, is to take a judgment against a tort defendant for whom there is substantive liability and impose that on that tort defendant's alter egos for the purpose of imposing liability of that judgment on parties who ought to be culpable for it. The case law that we've cited, not only Cali versus...
That's the purpose of your fraudulent conveyance causes of action?
That is the purpose of both, but they serve separate ends.
Yeah.
Meaning one is if, in fact, we can, which we believe we can, show that fraudulent conveyances were made, there would be substantive liability for that fraudulent conveyance. Yeah. If, in either in this case or hypothetically in another case, there were no fraudulent conveyances, we believe that nevertheless you can impose liability for the judgment on a third party who is an alter ego of the judgment defendant. In fact, we believe that's the very purpose of the alter ego doctrine as it applies to LLCs under the Gardner II case.
So what, in your view, are the elements of alter ego in a claim made against a non-culpable alleged alter ego?
The elements would be those the same as those outlined for a corporation. So it would be commingling of assets. It would be too much control where you exercise complete dominion over the corporation or the entity, and it would be the abuse of the corporate formality to commit a fraud.
And none of those factors are present in any of the statutory provisions that Ms. Goldsmith talked about in the context of spendthrift trusts.
That is true. However, our belief is that the NRS 163.418 applies equally to spendthrift trusts when it provides that an alter ego, or suggests at least that alter ego is an available remedy against trusts by setting forth factors that cannot be considered in determining whether the alter ego analysis applies. We believe that if the legislature had intended a blanket outright prohibition...
Wouldn't that, at least in the context of spendthrift trusts, wouldn't that run contrary to the legislature's expectations that if you do all the things you're supposed to do to set up a spendthrift trust and you satisfy the time periods and so forth, and now we're still going to get you under an alter ego theory? You think that's what the legislature had in mind?
Respectfully, I believe the legislature's intent was to make, we agree, was to make Nevada an attractive place for people to create trusts and to make it very difficult for a creditor to access trusts, but not to make it completely 100% impossible, no matter the facts of the case, to access the assets of a trust. And so we believe there is a heightened burden It would not be identical, for example, to the test imposed in Gardner 2 on an LLC or in Loomis or some of the other cases on a corporation. We would embrace a heightened burden of showing clear and convincing evidence of the abuse of the trust form and clear and convincing evidence of fraud in an effort to defraud creditors. We believe when this case gets sent back to the federal district court, we will be able to meet that heightened burden. And so I don't dispute that there is a different burden and a different expectation with respect to trusts than there is with respect to other entity forms. But the notion that the Nevada legislature intended to completely prohibit ever a trust, spendthrift trust from being subject to the alter ego doctrine is just not consistent with the legislative terms, in our view. Because NRS 163.418 contemplates scenarios or factors that should not be considered in an alter ego analysis, it therefore follows that there must be some factors out there that should be considered in an alter ego analysis, and that alter ego...
Disagree or do you agree with the analysis under the amicus brief?
I think we agree in part. We agree certainly with the analysis under irrevocable trusts that 163.418 proves the intent not to apply to an irrevocable trust. I believe, if memory serves, that the trust section in their brief stated expressly that Section 163 also applies equally to spendthrift trusts. And so to the extent that that is an accurate representation of their position, we agree with that. And we also agree with the proposition that if there is an abuse or a failure to comply with the terms of the trust instrument as well as the terms of Nevada law, then that would be a basis for a finding of alter ego. And I believe the evidence here showed Judge Gordon below that there was a failure to follow the trust formalities that were set forth in the trust instrument, including the way that money was spent on behalf of Mr. Magliardini.
Do you think the Klobaka case has any impact at all on these certified questions?
Yes, I think the Klobaka case certainly sheds light on some of these issues. I don't think that it, as defendants suggest in their brief, that it forecloses the position that we're articulating here for two reasons. First, Klobaka, as the court knows, is not an alter ego case. In Klobaka, the ultimate finding was that the trust could not be used to satisfy personal obligations of the spouse to pay alimony and child support. The finding was not that the trust could not, under alter ego circumstances, be used to satisfy that, because as I understand Klobaka, the issue of whether the trustee or trustor and the person with the obligation to pay child support were alter egos was never briefed, and I don't believe there was evidence submitted to the trial court to that effect in that case. And so to that end, because we have the separate alter ego allegations in this case and proof, at least for purposes of sufficient to obtain a preliminary injunction, that takes us outside of that finding in Klobaka. The second distinction in Klobaka is, I think, what is articulated by the court in footnote 5 of that opinion, which indicates that the protections of Chapter 166 for a spendthrift trust do not apply to a fraudulent conveyance action where a creditor is seeking to recover for a fraudulent conveyance. And so we believe, for the reasons set forth in our brief, particularly with
respect to... So you think footnote 5 extends to alter ego claims as well?
I believe that it extends to the arguments we are making that the alter ego and fraudulent conveyance claims should be read in conjunction, meaning that if an alter ego makes a fraudulent transfer at the demand or behest of the judgment debtor, Mr. Magliardini, as the evidence that Judge Gordon found it did in this case, then that is sufficient under the definition in the Nevada Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act of a debtor and of a transfer to create a fraudulent conveyance made by the debtor, just the same as if it had been made by himself versus if it is being made by the alter ego of the debtor.
But are they the same thing, though? That's one of the issues we're really worried about, fraudulent transfer claims and the facts that relate to that versus alter ego. Aren't they totally two separate issues, or do you think they've merged together?
They are distinct issues, but I believe the case law permits the use of a finding of alter ego to impose liability for a fraudulent conveyance on the alter ego as if the fraudulent conveyance had been made by the judgment debtor, Mr. Magliardini himself. And I believe the reason for that is, for example, the definition of a debtor is a person who owes money on a claim. And then if you look to the definition of a claim, it also includes unliquidated causes of action or unliquidated efforts to collect would be included in that. Efforts to impose the alter ego would constitute an unliquidated claim. We don't have that reduced to judgment yet, but that does not mean that the Fraudulent Transfer Act does not apply yet. And I also want to quickly cover a recent case from this court. I believe it's the NR2 Bayou case that came out in March. NCP Bayou 2 LLC case that came out in March 2019. And in that case, the court stated, quote, any transfers involving Med Tucson LLC, a corporation created by the debtor, its sole member, cannot be considered transfers made by the debtor, and the reason for that was because the third-party corporation had not been named as a party, and there was no assertion of an alter ego theory in order to pierce the corporate veil. And so that case, although it's an unpublished opinion, I believe is persuasive authority that had the third party been added in that case and had an alter ego claim been asserted in that case, then the court would have permitted at least going through the, may I complete my thought?
Yes. In fact, I'm going to give you an additional 2 minutes. I think the time adjustment might be a little off after hearing this argument. So why don't you take another 2 minutes?
I believe that had there been evidence in that case and allegations of an alter ego, and had the plaintiff complied with Cali and added the alleged alter egos as defendants, those court there would have permitted the use of the alter egos as the debtor who's making the fraudulent transfer, and thus would have allowed the fraudulent conveyance claim to proceed against those debtors. Does that address the question?
Yes, thank you.
And am I out of time?
No, you have a minute 39.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. The last point that I want to make is on the equities that this court has set forth in applying the alter ego doctrine to both limited liability companies and corporations. In the recent Gardner 2 case, the court articulated a concern that if there were no ability to pierce the veil of an LLC, then people would just be incentivized to create LLCs that are undercapitalized to engage in risky or liability-producing activity with no recourse. And that was the policy factor, or at least one of the policy factors, that went into the court in Gardner 2 applying LLCs, even absent statutory authority, applying the alter ego doctrine to LLCs. That exact same policy interest is implicated here, where there will be a total incentive for people to take their LLCs, take their corporations, and put them into trusts, and essentially kill the ability to apply the alter ego doctrine to any entity if it's owned by a trust, in this case, a spendthrift trust. And I think to do so would run afoul of the instruction in LFC marketing and in Gardner 2 more recently, that the entire purpose of the alter ego doctrine is to do justice and to prevent injustice in the abuse of an entity form.
What do you think about Gardner 1? Does that have any impact on this case?
I don't think the Gardner 1 directly implicated anything here. I'm happy to answer any specifics about Gardner 1 if the court has any. But for these reasons, we believe that the certified questions should be answered in the affirmative and back to the court below. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Cook, I think you have, let's round it off at 2 minutes for you here.
I believe DJM is a spendthrift trust. I think it's in the 700s. I haven't been able to find the appendix page, but I did find footnote 2 of the order, the reconsideration order from Judge Gordon that begins in footnote 2, the DJM irrevocable trust and Fain trust appear to meet the requirements of spendthrift trusts, and the plaintiffs do not dispute that they do. I would also add that the only asset, my understanding, the only asset in the DJM trust is the life insurance policy of Dominic Magliarditi. So unless he managed to do something only two people have done before, he could never get the asset anyway. So he certainly isn't a beneficiary of it. The spendthrift trust is not challenged at the formation. It's nowhere in the complaint. It's conceded not only in the footnote, but in the transcript. So it's a little taken aback that now they're saying, well, we still might do that, because with regard to the Fraudulent Transfer Act, the statute of repose was gone a year before they filed. And with regard to challenging the trust itself, that was gone 6 months after discovery, which they admit was a year and a half plus 4 days before they filed. With regard to a debtor, it could not have been the intent to include an alter ego as a debtor. I think it's a little naive to think that the legislator forgot about that and just didn't include it, particularly because under insiders, they include a person in control of a debtor. So I think they wanted a debtor to include a person in control of a corporation. They could have used that language. They didn't. I don't see any reason to expand that statute now. Similarly, a transfer didn't happen here because one of the criteria, and while transfer itself is broadly defined, it's the transfer of an asset. If it wasn't Dominic's asset, and it wasn't Dominic's asset unless he got it, that's not what they're complaining of. The stuff in the trust...
Go ahead and finish your thought.
Thank you. Was not yet an asset. So because asset is, excludes even things like community property, it's nonsensical to argue that her community property would be excluded, but her separate property wouldn't. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Justice Hardesty has a question. Mr. Cook, come on back up, please.
Well, to Mr. Cook or to Ms. Goldsmith, I want to clarify something, probably better to Ms. Goldsmith, but is it the section's view that the factors in 163.418 apply to spendthrift trusts? And did you say that in your brief? I understood you to say something different here.
Ms. Goldsmith, why don't you come up so we can get a record of this? Come up to the podium, please.
So what's required with 166 is 163.418 and 4177 do apply, but you have to, they would apply, if you've complied with the statute, so if you've complied with 166 and you have compliance under 166.171, creditors may not pursue an action to recover a transfer of property to a spendthrift trust if the person was a creditor when the transfer was made, unless the action is brought within 2 years after the transfer is made, or 6 months after the person discovers the transfer, or should have discovered, whichever is later. If the person becomes a creditor after the transfer is made, unless it's commenced within 2 years after the transfer is made. So if you are just, you are a spendthrift trust and you could have, you may have where you've not met this, right? So if you've, you may not have been a long enough spendthrift trust. So you're really just an irrevocable trust. Mm-hmm. It's really at that point when you would be looking at the factors of applying 163.
Okay.
So it does, if you've complied, what I'm trying to say is if you've complied with 166.170.7 and the time has run and you did that appropriately, you didn't have problems in that, it should be respected. Now, just because, let's suppose an action is filed or discovered and you are within this purview as a self-settled spendthrift trust, so you haven't satisfied the requirement of 171, then you would have a situation where you could look to 163.4177. Because you then would have be just an irrevocable trust without completing the provisions. So assuming you've satisfied the statutes, and what the section wants to be clear is that it's conformity with the statutory requirements. If you've dotted your I's and crossed your T's, that's very important. The other thing that the section, I think, really needs to be clear is that we're dealing with, in these statutes, the settlors, and that's settlers or a beneficiary, and it's important to look at those definitions as well.
Mr. Cook, did you have just a second? Is there a question for Mr. Cook from any of the justices?
No, but if he wants to, as it relates to his own case, I think he should be allowed to comment.
Go ahead, Mr. Cook.
I appreciate that. From our perspective, how I read the brief was, I think, how the question was framed, which is, if it's a spendthrift trust, those provisions are not going to apply unless you're applying them at the creation of a trust, i.e. it was formed to avoid a creditor. Remember, 2000 and 2006 is when we're talking about with these, but to avoid a creditor that at least at that point didn't exist, or they were not properly formed. It doesn't appear to be any allegation that they were improperly formed. And I would add, just because I did find the page when I sat down. It was 782 of the appendix that has the spendthrift clause and 11B of the DJM trust.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bex. I'm going to give you a chance to respond as well briefly to both of your colleagues over here.
The only point that I would make is that nothing in NRS 163, 418, or 4177, or Chapter 166, says anything that would prevent the court from determining that the legislature intended for alter ego and those factors enunciated for consideration under alter ego to apply with equal force to both an irrevocable and a spendthrift trust.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you all for your excellent arguments and briefs. We appreciate it. It's a big case, as you can see, obviously, for us to look at all these issues and make sure we get them right. We're trying our best on that. So this time we'll take the case under submission, and we'll be in recess until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.